Welcome back to the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, and joined as always by my good friend and colleague, John Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
We showed up. We're back, baby. Giving the people not only what they want, what they need.
That is right. We are here to deliver as always, and we've got another exciting topic today. But before we get into that, just a reminder, you know what's coming. The Running Scholar Program. Why haven't you signed up?
Sign up.
That's the question. So we've got over 400 coaches. That means you get to take courses on everything from Canova to Lydiard to training for the 5K mile marathon, everything in between, science, physiology, biomechanics, and you get access to an exclusive conversation piece where we call the Scholar Clubhouse, where you get to chat with 400 other great coaches and John and I and get all your questions answered, debate. It's like Twitter for the cool kids without the trolls.
Exactly. The Clubhouse is the digital hangout for scholars. We host it on a Discord server. We were on Discord before a lot of people were. It's a great app and a great server for a community. Plus, the great thing is we're the moderators. We're at control. So people start acting foolish, we just kick them out. But no one has, because you know why? All scholars are here for learning, exposure, leveling up, and growing their mindset about how they approach this wild and crazy thing called training and racing.
That's right. We figured out, John, how to create the Twitter or message board without the craziness in Discord. So maybe someone will hire us to run Twitter now.
There you go.
Sure, in the chaos. But in all seriousness, this is why I love it and I'm spending more and more time there, is because it's actual real coaching dialogue. So sounds good to you, like, sign up, test it out, see if you like it for a month. And I'm going to tell you, I've gotten so many emails. Yes. So many emails where people have emailed me and be like, Steve, John, I don't know why I waited so long. Like, this is a gold mine. Not kidding you. I've gotten like a dozen of those emails in the last couple weeks. I'm like,
yeah, me too. Me too.
Here we are.
Yeah. I mean, where else can you get access to people who actually have skin in the game, helping other people out on their coaching and running journey? Like, we have, you know, Sean O'Day, the coach of the number two, you know, nationally ranked boys cross country team at Cheyenne Mountain, you know, in there in this clubhouse, helping other coaches out and saying, hey, here's how I did it. Or, hey, I tried this experiment with, like, athletes of, you know, lower qualification, and this is what happened. I mean, where else can you get that? The answer is nowhere else.
Yes. And you know what? I'm just going to say it. We got Mike Smith is part of the Scholar Program. We've got, I'm not going to call, Mike has admitted it, so I'm going to do that. Yeah. But I'm going to say, behind the scenes, we've got coaches who are actively coaching people who are winning major, like, major marathons, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Like, major ones. And I'm always, I'm like, oh, like, you're part of the program. You're learning. Great. Yeah. Like, come on board. So, you know, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for all of us. So,
yes. And right now, like, I'm running the sports development or sport form development channel, which is my way of doing little mini courses or things of that, where you've heard me talk about, like, Bonnerchuk's methodology of what's, you know, known as concentrated or constant loading, and demonstrating why, first and foremost, it is another opportunity, because it synthesizes both block periodization as well as complex periodization into one chunk. But more importantly, it is integrated for specific individual athletes. That's what makes it so powerful, this concept of auto-regulation, where it's not just, we're going to periodize to the calendar training and training loads, we're actually going to periodize those training loads to the adaptability of the individual. And so this is just another tool in your toolbox to help make how you think about solving the training puzzle for each individual athlete, because we get that all the time. How do I individualize training? this is one way to do it. So if you're really concerned and curious about how to do that successfully, don't take my word for it. Don't take Steve. Take Dr. Anatoly Bondarchuk's word for it, who is the most successful coach of all time, having coached the Olympic medalists, all three on the podium, all three, four consecutive Olympics for the men's hammer. No one else is better. Like, I mean, Steve, how awesome would that be if you could coach the entire Olympic podium in your event, four events or four consecutive Olympics in a row, not to mention the world championships? It's insane.
Yeah, that's nuts. Well, that's another level, man. That's another level.
So,
speaking of nuts and another level, this week, our podcast, See God Workouts, Reckless or Indispensable?
Now, this is like one of those topics where Steve and I might have differing views. So it's going to be good to dialogue about this.
Oh, no, man. Not differing views.
Oh, no.
We can't have differing views here. We've got
to agree on everything. I thought this was the Echo Chamber podcast.
Yes. Yes. This is where we all agree on everything. Okay. So I'm going to set the stage. So listeners, if you're not familiar, what in the world is a See God workout? So I'm going to go all the way back to my high school days, because although I say this word a lot, I've kind of popularized it. It did not come from me, which is this. Way back in high school, you know, I'm training in the suburbs of Houston, Texas. It's hot, humid, miserable, all that good stuff. My coach, every once in a while, we'd show up to the track, we'd show up to the park we run out, and he'd have this look in his eye, and he'd be like, "Boys, today you're gonna go see God." And we knew what that meant. It was a very rare occasion, but we knew what that meant, and here's what it meant. It went, today's workout, we were gonna go until we were so exhausted that we might just feel like we're going to see God at the end because we're dying, right? And the point of this workout, again, very rare, but the point of this workout, he would say, is like, this is a perspective changer. This is to say, hey, you know, normally our workouts are hard but controlled and like you could do another rep or what have you, but today is a day where the sole goal is to like get to that point of utter physical and mental exhaustion and to just kind of see what's there and to like shift your perspective on A, what that feeling is like, and B, maybe what you're kind of capable of in those moments. So that is, my friends, the origin of See God Workouts. It comes from my high school coach, Gerald Stewart, who I'm going to give him some credit here because this is what we do on this pod. Is what I loved about Coach Stewart is this, is about 5 years before I got to high school, he coached a kid who was, I think, number one in the nation in the triple jump. Okay. My freshman year, he was the sprint coach and coached the kid who was number one in the nation in the 100 that year, 1999, who ran 10.28 fully automatic. And then my senior year, he coached me to like be number one in the nation in the mile. So we've got, you know, it was just the coach's coach, like just coach all events and like get it done. And it's like the old school model. So that's why I love sharing that story. But anyway, See God Workouts. That's what we're talking about today. Yeah, so to me, let me set the stage on where I can consider using them. So again, in my kind of mindset program, is most workouts are manageable, controlled, hard, all that stuff. But maybe like once or twice a year or in a season, I like to do kind of a See God workout where we just go to the well and we see what's in that well. And as I explained earlier, I think the reason that I like to do that is because A, it's almost psychological, right? Well, there's some physiological to it too, which I'll explain. But psychologically, I think it shifts our perspective. It makes us less afraid of going to that point because we've been somewhere close before, right? It's not like we have this fear of like, oh, what's this going to feel like? How am I going to be like? We go towards it, right? B, I think there's something like psychological on the team where it's like, you know, this isn't going to happen all the time because you're not going to burn, you know, your bridges all the time. But every once in a while, you're going to do this workout where it's like, all right, like the team knows that it's not about hitting the splits necessarily. It's not about having this fantastic workout. Sometimes it is a fantastic workout. Sometimes it's not. But it's just the sole goal is effort of like go to the freaking well. And then physiologically, I think there's something too. You know, normally I say just embarrass your body, right, to adapt. Like you embarrass it a little bit so it learns to grow and get stronger. I think there's something too every once in a while to like having a big perspective changer in terms of your stimulus where your body doesn't just get embarrassed, but it gets like overwhelmed where it's just like, oh crap, like this is nuts. Like I really got to adapt. Now, whether that's true or not, there's some evidence that might be helpful, some that's not, because like who the hell wants to study going to the absolute well? But I think there's something theoretically to that that we can wrap our head around. So what do I do? As I said, maybe once every season, we just do a workout where it's like, go to the well. And there's some, you can do this at almost any point. One of my favorite, especially in track, is like the classic, you know, 400s, because I think those allow you, if you do like 8 to 10 by 400 with a minute rest, that allows you to just go to the depths of just like total acidosis and feeling like you're fried at the end, right? In cross country, I often like my, you know, sometimes we'll do what I call kind of a shortened down mile repeat. So instead of doing like 5 to 6 mile repeats, maybe we do 3 or 4 where it's progressive. And by the last one, you're just trying to crank, man. Like you're just going. And one of the things that I like to do actually is like play with the team a little bit where I'll start people at staggered intervals where they're just kind of getting chased down. Right. So you start the slowest person first and then like go on it. And what happens is the slowest person is running like, oh my gosh, like I have a chance to beat the faster people because like I can hold them off because I've been staggered, and the faster people are like, oh, I'm going to go crazy and try and catch these people. And you add a little competition to it and they're just like done at the end, fried. So again, you can do this in a number of different avenues. Actually, one of my favorite ways to do this that I think actually is a little safer. So whenever people critique CGOD workouts, and I'm sure we're going to get into that, you know, often the critique is, well, that's, you know, that's difficult. Like that can set you back. That can dig you in a hole. Absolutely. One of my favorite ways to kind of guard against this, and it's harder in Houston, but we used to do this a lot in the suburbs of Houston, is we'd go to a hill that was about 400 meters long. And we just run 400s up the stupid hill until like, you know, at some point you're just like, you get to the top of the hill on one of the repeats and you just like fall to the ground and like, I can't go up another hill. Like I'm done. Like you're just exhausted. And I think that's a little bit safer physiologically for a simple reason, is that because you're running up the hill, it's a little more nonspecific. So the negatives of like overloading your body with maybe acidosis in a specific manner are negated a little bit because you've changed the muscle fiber recruitment so that it's not in the exact muscle fibers, the exact pattern of recruitment that you would if you were, say, running 400s on the track. So often hills are a good way to kind of get to that point without maybe as much negative or downside.
I like it. Yeah, I'm definitely in the not a fan camp for a variety of reasons, but I do see the efficacy in, say, the perspective change and demonstrating to someone in like a finite moment or finite unitary session, the robustness, resiliency, and even to a certain degree, anti-fragility of their human body. Like, you know, that's always one of the things we're doing in training is helping athletes explore their limits and boundaries. And we know through a lot of psychology and study, the boundary and the physical limit is often, you know, a lot further than what we think it is because the body is so good at creating buffers and it likes its buffers. I approach this a little different to get that same type of exhaustion. Because if we look at the general adaptation syndrome, right? There's a lot to be had through pushing through that alarm state, getting to that point of resistance, and then actually visiting a little bit that point of exhaustion, because that triggers a whole variety of different biochemical, neurological, physiological, structural adaptations to potentially happen. For me, the whole see God workout concept, it's just the risk reward is not favorable enough to me, because it's like, this is such a hard thing. It's so, you know, much on the, you know, the global system of the body, physically and mentally, emotionally, that you don't know necessarily how long the restoration and recuperation after that workout happens. And it's very tough to manage, I think, because it might be 10 days, could be, you know, 10 hours. It all depends on the individual, right? I'm a fan of like efforts, like say the All You Got efforts, made famous by say Ron Warhurst's Michigan workout, where at the end, when you're in the most fatigued state of either medium dig cycle, where it's consecutive concentrated loadings or very consolidated concentrating loadings or workouts. For example, like a progression of 3 workouts in 6 days that, you know, you just don't fully recover from any one of those workouts. So by the time you get to that third workout, you are in this kind of depleted, semi-exhausted state. And then maybe having one rep where it's like one all you got 400 towards the end there, seeing where you're at. Now, it is conceptually very similar, but it's just the time horizons for how I try to approach this is a little bit longer, right? It's more about over the span of several days versus several minutes, you know, because I've seen it in the gym. I've seen it, you know, elsewhere where people are going for it and really trying to like max effort, max intensity, or super max even, right? Like exceed their current PR time, weight, or what have you. And what happens is you can get psychologically so wound up that sometimes you actually can override the physiology and override your body and tear something, break something. Like I've seen it. It's wild. But you know, you're in this kind of like pre-shock state to get yourself so motivated to do it that you can supersede those physical signals and alarms and go force your body to do something that structurally is just not ready for. And that's, to me, the risk reward. I think the coach has to be very cognizant of when they make a decision to engage in some type of see God activity, because if the athlete is structurally unsound or structurally incapable of sustaining pushing themselves beyond their limit, it can become something that's very reckless.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with that nuance. So here's what I think. We're all about finding agreement here on this podcast. I think if I'm thinking this through on the fly, I think there is a lot of value in that perspective changing, but I do think it matters a lot when you introduce it and how you do it. So my kind of inclination here is, like, as a coach, is you got to know when to pull that trigger and how you're going to pull that trigger and how it will impact other people. So a couple things come to mind on this is, A, doing a true see God workout where it's just like from the get-go is just like, let's crush, is really mentally and physically draining, as you said. Mm-hmm. So it's one of, if we go back to the barbell, it's on the far right where it's like high risk, high reward.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's taken the big bet.
Yeah, into the all in, just yeah, put your chips all in.
Put your mm-hmm. chips all in. So to me, it's like knowing when and if you want to do that. A more maybe sustainable way is to do what you just said there, which is like test your limits in the last, we'll call it the last rep, right? Mm-hmm. It's like test your limits in the last rep. Well, it's not the whole workout. It's just a couple, you know, a minute or two or whatever it is that you're really kind of digging and concerned about. So it's a little bit safer. It's not, it's still some higher reward maybe, but it's not the as high a risk. So you're getting some of the benefits, the bang for your buck, but without the, oh gosh, this could dig us in a hole that we can't get out of risk.
Yeah. Quick aside, this is basically under Scott Rasko's training, Alan Webb's MO yes. for workouts was build, and just a little, as Alan would say, just a little spice at the end, just a little, and that was it.
Yeah, no, that is great. And if you're in the scholar program, you get to see some of those. Yeah. But it was like Rasko would just kind of build, includes things in sets. And then once you get to that last set, you're pretty tired, but like he's modulated the recovery so that like mm-hmm. you're able to crush that last rep or last thing.
Right? Oh, we should talk. I mean, we need a podcast about Rasko's ability to modulate recovery, which when you look at it on paper and Alan's training logs, it is a beautiful thing. It hurts people's head because it's not static, but it's like his ability to modulate and know how to modulate recovery in the workout, on the fly, in the moment is probably like bar none out of what I've seen on paper, you know, from efficacy and intelligence standpoint of almost any kind of coach out there.
Yeah, no, it's we should make yeah. note of that, John, yeah, because it's a little notes. Different from your hey, we're gonna have 1 minute rest on everything, or 90 right. seconds rest, or 2 minutes rest, or what have you. It was always fluctuating.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sounds a lot like a concept called flux training. I love it.
So anyways, all right. So getting back to it. So I think as a coach, like what you're looking at is, well, what are you trying to get out of this? And what's your tolerance for risk with this athlete? So for many athletes, it's probably better just to do the last rep thing. For some athletes, it's better, it might be better to take the big swing mm-hmm. to say, hey, we've got to change your perspective on all of this. Like, you've got to learn how to do it. And, you know, as I'm thinking about this, another concept comes to my mind, actually one that former Boston Marathon winner Ambie Burfoot passed along to me way back in the day. And he was like, yeah, one of the things that, you know, my coach would do sometimes, and I do with some of the athletes I worked with, is he called it like this. It was like the sneaky last rep where you do the moderate controlled workout that is pretty hard. The let's just use, you do 10 400s. They're all in 65. They're a minute rest. It's hard, but like you've made it through, you think you're done. And then the coach goes, oh, never mind. We're going to do 11th.
Ooh, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is the same kind of perspective changing, maybe in a slightly safer way, but you think you're done. That relief has come over you. You've measured your workout correctly. You've got to the finish where you think, okay, I'm really tired, but I'm not spent. And then the coach says, okay, one more rep on the line, let's go. And you have to shift, get in the mood. And then the idea behind that is, it's again that perspective changing where you get through the workout and you realize, I thought I was done at 10, but really I had enough energy for number 11 because I made it through.
Yeah, I like that. Another thing that I've employed as well is a variant of Scott Simmons' hammer rep, or what he calls hammer intervals, but really are hammer reps, where you're going to run, let's just take the 15 by a quarter example. And on this number and this number, you're going to hammer the rep really, really, really fast. We'll create this really big spike in lactate and then continue back on course for the next several reps at the, you know, prescribed pace. So Scott Simmons's, you know, presentation of that is to give the athlete beforehand up front the number of the interval number or rep number that they're going to hammer. What I've done in the past is told athletes, all right, this workout we're going to do, let's say 15 times a quarter, there will be a maximum of 3 hammer reps, maybe not fully 3. And so it gives the coach now this, an athlete aware, like, okay, I better stay controlled and on pace for the ones that aren't, because it's coming and I don't know when. And if you say up to, right, a maximum, you create this this window for you to go up to as a coach, but maybe it's only one, maybe it's only two. And sometimes I've even done like one and a half, right? Where it's like, all right, we're going to do a quarter. And then looking at the athletes saying, okay, we could probably get away with one more 200, but another full quarter just is not on the books today. And so by modulating in that regard and creating that variant, it allows the coach to be a little bit more receptive to the feedback that the athlete's demonstrating within the workout and their rates of fatigue or their rates of difficulty. And it gives them a perspective chain because they don't know when that curveball is coming. And I've done it as soon as like the second rep of a workout. And I've also like delayed it, if we're doing, say, 15 quarters here, until like the 13th one. So it's just kind of this thing, this ominous ghost that's on their shoulders the entire time. Like, ugh. And, you know, I've never ever gone over my maximum limit. And rarely have I ever hit the maximum limit. Because I've always just like to keep that one extra one dangling. So usually what I do is I think, okay, what's the maxima I want to, ideally predict to subject the athlete to in this workout, and then always go plus one. So they always just kind of think one more is coming, but it never does. Kind of cruel, but
One more is coming, but not really.
Not really.
I like it. No, I like it because like, what we're doing here is kind of, again, getting this psychological manipulation where you're trying to show, it's almost like you're trying to get the athlete to realize that he's exploring.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that like his limits, he thinks or she thinks, are X, Y, and Z, but they're really not, right? They're capable of more in this manner, and you're essentially dabbling in here. And maybe this, the kind of, okay, well, how do we use this stuff? It's realizing that you have a bunch of different options on how to do it. Mm-hmm. It's like you have the nuclear bomb option. And then you have like the smaller, like maybe more, guided missile approach or drone approach, whatever.
Or the dirty bombs. Yes.
The dirty bombs. Like you have your different things and you need to know when to use them to kind of like, hey, poke and prod these in the right direction.
Yeah, I think, that's the thing, right, is I agree 100%. In practice, we need to have concrete examples, or the athlete needs to have concrete examples of demonstrated action or demonstrated ability that they can push their limits beyond what they think, because that gives them confidence. You can't ask them to do that in a race. You can't ask a sea god all out effort, give it everything you got in a race. And that's what I love about the best coaches, is they never ask athletes for anything other than, as Mike Smith would say, a good effort. Not great effort, because a lot of times people go in with this heightened expectation on race day. Everything needs to be perfect. Everything needs to be top notch, like all my ducks in a row. There is no contingency plan for if things go not according to perfect. It's the overly optimistic approach. I prefer to have a realistic approach versus a pessimistic approach of saying, just good. If you deliver good, based off all your training, all your preparation, we think that will put you in a competitive position for your development as an athlete at this point in your career. And that all of a sudden creates a lot less anxiety, stress, and psychological burden. But in practice, that is the safe space to explore the ability to go beyond perceived limits. Now, the reason I, am hesitant on the nuclear bomb see God option, because most people, I think, associate it with the fictional Quentin Cassidy character's workout of 400s until he was bleeding in through the eyes, right? Whereas coach is just like, another set of 20 times 400, another set of 20 times 400. It's this old militaristic, like, break you so far down, right? That like, we gotta do this, get you tough. But we know, right, from, because it was also the influence of that fictional session was actually Zatopek, right? And we know from Zatopek's own career and his reflections that there is a sweet spot to the amount of volume and duration that he felt got him prepared, because his only option, right, and what he thought it was his downfall after his, you know, glorious, you know, triple Olympic gold in Helsinki, was to do more work, but it ended up becoming corrosive. And then, you know, Vladimir Kutz was like, no, there's an optima. And the optima is this amount of volume, and then to increase the intensity or speed of the work. And then that's why Vladimir Kutz was out there, you know, taking all of his Zatopek's world records immediately after. He just understood what Zatopek didn't was the path to improvement was not more, because you already reached the volume maxima. The path to improvement was better. And that's, I think, a hard place for us to go as coaches and athletes sometimes, because more is easier. Because it's super simple. You just increase the volume, increase this. And a lot of people will hang their hats on the various, you know, studies about mitochondria density and efficacy and how it's related to just more volume, and more volume means more mitochondria and blah, blah, blah. And we know that's true. But we also know more intensity creates is another enzymatic signaling pathway to create more mitochondria as well. So it's a balance.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad you brought up that that Zatopek, because that kind of gets it, and the Quinn Cassidy. I think often when, you know, what I'm hearing from you is when we see Sea God, the atomic bomb reference, we often think like, oh my gosh, the Quinton Cassidy. And yeah. It could be, but like what we're saying is not necessarily like going to that place is the best all the time. And I'm going to give you another example, which I think is pertinent, that I was reading actually yesterday, which is on the you know, one of the American greats, George Young, who sadly passed away this week at 85. But George Young, for those, most people probably know him as the guy that Prefontaine battled at the 1972 Olympic trials in the Prefontaine movies, right?
Right, yeah.
George Young. That's where, well, George Young was, I think, 34 or 35 at that point, which in the 70s, that was a long career.
That was, yeah. You were ancient.
Yeah. So, but what most people don't realize is Young made four Olympics from 60, 64, 68, and 72, and then was a bronze medalist in 68. And speaking of that 72 race, so he got beat by Prefontaine. And what happened was he thought, oh man, I got dusted by Prefontaine, because he had that, you know, last 800 or whatever in 2 minutes. And Young was like, oh, I'm in great shape, but I can train harder. And that pushed him to like change his training, where he went to the freaking well. He went back to, you know, his old training regime of running until he dropped.
Oof, brutal.
And what happened? Well, he missed the final at the Olympics in the 5K, even though he was capable of making the final, like had the ability. I think he ran 13:41 in the heats when he ran 13:29 at the trials, and he was always a good kicker and couldn't kick. And he just, you know, said essentially, you know, I made the mistake. I went back to the running till I dropped when I should have stuck with what was working. And he's like, again, 35 at that point, like one of the best in history, and especially in America at that point. And you're riding that razor's edge. And that's the difficult part of knowing when and how to like use these perspective changers. Because if you get it wrong, you know, you're going to be like George Young, wrong side of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I often say, right, if you don't know what you're doing, you're just more is the answer. And a lot of times, too, if you're also very insecure about what you're doing or insecure about your results, more is the answer. But we're not after more. We're always after better. I mean, you know, it's not like they're saying, hey, we're going to increase the distance of the 5K. We're going to increase the distance of the 10K. No, the goal is to run a specific event where the distance of it is not increasing, decreasing, it's static. The goal is to run it faster. Right? Better. And the hard part about overreaching, functional overreaching versus overtraining, is this such a fine line. It is, I call it the brink of exhaustion. And that's like, that's what we're really trying to do with these types of workouts or loading patterns, is take someone up into that point of the brink of exhaustion, just enough to create the biggest embarrassment, the biggest alarm bell, because you got to remember, no stress equals no change. So we have to disrupt homeostasis really, really, really significantly to get change in the athlete, to get the adaption. But it is a necessary enterprise to foster that growth and that improvement. Yet the ability for us to make it something, you know, adverse to the athlete, a maladaption, is also really high too. So it's so much of an art, because we have to understand what the signs and signals of maladaptation are, not only just at an acute level in the moment, like if glycogen is depleted. And that's a really interesting thing to show, like sometimes, right, glycogen depletement has a really strong signaling towards mitochondrial respiration and efficacy and density growth. But what happens when you do CGI workouts, what they can do is become too acidosis too quickly, because you've just made it totally glycolytic. And what ends up happening is the cellular reactions, because of the positive H ions and acidosis, fundamentally stop the twitch of the muscle fibers. They just get in there and stop the twitch. And so you have to abort and end the workout before the athlete actually gets any real beneficial training impact. And this is for endurance athletes, right? And when I say endurance, I mean short, or what we call short endurance or distance athletes of anywhere from 10 minutes to 40 minutes. So 5K runners up to 15K, as well as long endurance or long distance athletes. Rules are a little different with middle distance runners, but we got to remember the whole goal of training is to get a trainable effect. And if we can't get that trainable effect on the athlete, we can, I mean, there's, it's easy to work you really hard and get you tired, but getting the trainable effect is a very delicate thing. And so that's why I too shy away from the atomic bomb CGI workouts, because the reality is, can a Quentin Cassie type situation actually exist in reality without severe repercussions? The answer is no way. It's totally made up. Like, come on. But we tend to like simple stories, right? It's that bias we have for the simpler the story, you know, the more linear cause and effect, correlation, causation, and direct, the easier it is to digest, but it's not always reality.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I'm in agreement here, which is there's nuance. And I think there's nuance in all of this stuff. And I still think the atomic bomb, we'll call it like CGOD, has a place. But I think it's like, maybe the amendment I would make is you need to do some sort of perspective changer, maybe once a year or so. Mm-hmm. And those options are A, B, C, D, you know, whatever we've outlined here. And I would probably say save the C God for like those who need it.
I mean, Steve, I like the Hill version of the C God workout, because for me, the hesitation is always on the structural soundness or stability of the athlete. And the Hills, you know, kind of amend that a little bit.
Well, you know, the wonderful thing about Hills is your body will stop you before you get hurt for most things. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is, as those muscle fibers fatigue, shut down, etc., like, you're just not going to run up the hill much fast. Like, you're going to slow way down. And slowing way down, I think in this guard, helps, because like the pounding, the stress on the joints, muscles, as your movement degrades, just gets... you're just going slower. So you're not going through that rapid contraction cycle, which I think is important. And it's also why you tend to, you know, it's why if you do hill sprints, they're safer than doing them on the track for sprints as introductory. Why? Because you're going uphill. So that changes the elastic components. It changes the foot placement and components where you're less likely to reach out because the hill is going upwards, right? And because of that, it makes it a slightly safer, even mechanical environment.
Yeah, just to add on that too, it is a more general form of running because the muscle groups engaged are also different. The hamstring is actually silent on hill running. We know this from Franz Bosch's works and other studies. So you're not going to get that hamstring pull or strain. So that minimization goes down. The hills going uphills primarily is about glutes, which is a very robust monoarticulate muscle. Like it is very, 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 very hard to strain the glute. Very hard. It's a big old muscle group, right? So that's another like positive in your direction. And then two, yeah, there is a little bit more of a quadricep burden placed on the muscles running up hills because, again, you don't have the hamstrings engaged because it's a different point in the gait cycle that the contact's made. But two, you're just slower in general because the foot is hitting the ground earlier than would allow that recruitment of these more elastic tissues. So you save a little bit on the strain that might happen on the calves and Achilles and all that type of stuff. So we often think about hills as strength training, but if you are in the Scholar program and you're taking the sports form development mini course that's a channel right now, and you're seeing in Bonnarchuk's exercise classification schematic, it is considered a special preparatory exercise, or specific preparatory exercise, which by definition, these are exercises that use the same muscle groups or similar muscle groups, but and physiology as the competitive exercise, but not entirely. It's more piecemealed. And that is hill training 101 because hamstrings are not as engaged. The elastic components of the short stretching cycle are not as engaged, but it's a really, really, really good glute development activity and runners need freaking strong glutes.
Exactly. That's very true. Very true. All right. So I'm not sure what else we have to say on this one. I think
I think the recommendation is, you know, let's just get clear, coherent recommendations. If you're going to do an atomic bomb, C-God workout, maximum is twice a season, maximum. Yeah. Maybe once, but max twice. And then, you know, if you're going to do it, like it needs to be about 2 weeks, I would say, away from an important race at a minimum.
Yep.
Ideally longer.
Give yourself space. This is the key here. Your recovery is proportional to the stress. So if you're going atomic bomb on stress, you got to give yourself the equivalent in rest and recovery.
Yeah. I mean, which would be quote unquote a deload week. Like don't try to do a CGOT workout and then do a long run or medium long run. It's like maybe the next day is a day off walking, hiking. The other day, next day is like 20 minutes jogging. I mean, it is, you know, like you said, it's proportional, but it's a big proportion. So you got to then make sure you buffer and plan for that on the back end about what your recovery horizon is going to look like.
Absolutely. Okay. So we've got C-God. And then we say, okay, if not, you have these other options.
Yeah, let's go through those.
Which are essentially, we'll call it one, you have the Scott Rasko. I'm just going to call it the Rasko, which is the build, and then let it loose that last one where you're modulating recovery and other things so that you can just crush it. Okay. Then I would say you have the other version, which is you have the other version we talked about, which is like the ambi-barefoot, I'm going to say, which is like add the rep. So get to the point in a normal workout and then press it a little further. Okay. And then what other versions do we have here, John?
Oh, well, we had the hammer rep.
The hammer rep
version. Yep. And then what Jerry Schumacher calls the medium dig cycle, or I call like the subacute concentrated loading cycle, where you're doing a series of hard workouts within a short consolidated period of time, like 3 workouts in 6 days.
Love it. So all of these, I would say, are on this kind of this in between where we're trying to change the perspectives, but in a safer way. Now, again, I would say here is like you only want to do these a handful of times in a season.
Mm-hmm.
Even these is like, and what I would say is, well, when do you do these? Well, when do you need the perspective changing? And then when do you have the space to, even though it's not an atomic bomb, you've got to, whenever you go to the well, you got to have the space to recover off of it.
That's the key, right? Yeah, it's two sides of the coin. You need that inverse or that time after for recovery. And if you mismanage that, it makes the session, the CGOT session or the, you know, the highly difficult session, you know, almost useless, right? It's more of a risk and a liability than it is actually an asset.
Exactly. So there you have it. Those are the variations. I would say, again, a handful of times, make sure you have the recovery. When do you know you can use it on an athlete? When they're in a spot where they need that perspective change and they can handle it. So you want to do it when they're rising, mm-hmm. and they can handle the thing, not when you're beating them down and that perspective is going to be in the negative, like, oh my gosh, I can't handle these workouts. My fitness is done. I'm out of here.
Yeah. And that's, you know, for the medium dig cycle or the subacute concentrating loading cycle, like that is a very specific thing that you do, you know, when you have about a month or so of training and recovery before the introduction into racing, right? And this is for kind of people who race a little higher frequency, half marathon runners and down. But also to know, like, depending on the frequency of your racing in the season, if you're in the track or even cross country, like, the athlete in the race is getting that perspective change with the final kick always. Like that last spurt, that last minute, that is an all you got, see God type affair. And so it creates this calibration. But if someone is not getting that perspective change via racing, you know, yes, then maybe a concentrated session is important. But also too, the most important thing, I remember this when I was you know, a high school coach the first time around, is we had this young lady who just wouldn't kick, didn't understand, wouldn't do it right. And then finally she was compelled enough in a race to do it because the, you know, the team point total depended on her beating two people. And she did it. She went for it. She got it because to her, it was super important to help the team's point total. And she got those two people. And then after she did it, not only myself, not only the other coaches involved, not only the athletes, you know, we even got some of the parents to really applaud that effort. And so what we did from a psychological perspective is we provide all this positive feedback and saying, look, in this context, in the moment, look, you did it, you survived, you didn't get hurt, you were able to recuperate, catch your breath after, you know, a minute or five, and look at what this produced, and it helped everyone involved. And so sometimes it actually needs to be highly contextual for an athlete,
yes.
As in the racing crucible itself. And it's not something that's just about them getting better, but also something about them helping their teammates and the team as a whole get better.
Love it. And what you're also adding there is highlighting its stuff. So kids learn from it, grow from it, and it's not just, oh, I went through this hard thing.
Right. And that's sometimes what happens is when you are going through a hard thing, you feel really isolated and you feel really vulnerable because it's just on you. And it's easy to give up or easy to like throw in the towel or sandbag a little bit if it's just you and you're not really motivated towards your direction or your goal. But as we know through the psychology and dynamics of group training, and the, you know, participation in group dynamics, that fosters a higher level of output from everyone in the group, as well as, you know, collectively and individually, that can then help propel all, you know, the boats, so to speak. So a rising tide lifts all boats. So that's another important dynamic, I think, too, when we want to change perspective, is anchoring the athlete's increased output or increased effort level in the benefit towards the group as a whole. And if we can create that anchor, psychological anchor for them, they can get a lot more out of themselves physiologically as well.
Love it. All right, everybody. Well, that is CGOD workouts. Those are perspective changers. That's how you get it done.
Love it. That was a good dialogue and discourse, Steve.
There you go. And you know where you can go to continue having discourse where, guess what, you can disagree and then find agreement and find the best way to do it. It's pretty simple.
Scholar Clubhouse, it is the spot.
That's right. No trolling, no yelling, just dialogue, baby.
Yeah.
So join us, have fun. You're going to learn a lot. And we appreciate you guys listening and hope you take something away. And we appreciate all those new scholars who are
so awesome. So exciting. We need more. The community gets stronger with each member that joins. Your membership, even if you're just watching, looking on this, you know, kind of being a wallflower, so to speak, not in the chat, chatting through all the various channels, even just you being around makes the program better. Because and I can't tell you how many people like direct message me or email me and just go, oh my God, this is awesome. Or, hey, I had a question I didn't want to ask, you know, in the entire group community server, but I want to ask you, get your perspective on. Like, it's just one of those like snowball things. Like, in 10 years from now, I have no doubt it will be a very valuable resource for a lot of success coaches will be having, because they were able to have constant exposure to new, different, alternative, novel ideas about how to train, develop, and prepare athletes to, you know, compete at the highest level possible.
Love it. Get on board, everybody. Well, thanks for listening. And until next time, keep doing what you're doing.